I know we left off in the book of Nehemiah, which is this lesson 23 about building the wall around Jerusalem, but I feel like I need to give you a little bit more of kind of a running start into it. So let me do this. So don't forget the big deal issue with Israel. They've got a united kingdom, King David, and then there is a split in the kingdom. There's a division, and we've got a northern part of the kingdom that takes on, for the most part, the name Israel. We've got a southern part of the kingdom in the division that takes on the name of Judah. Both of these, the northern part of Israel, goes into exile by the Assyrians. The southern kingdom of Judah goes into exile 130 or so years later by the Babylonians. And then for 70 years, Judah is in captivity. So they're living in Babylon, maybe some other areas around that empire. And after that 70 years is complete, they then come back home. This is where we are, and the return of the exiled peoples is what makes up the books of Ezra, Nehemiah, and Esther. So we talked about Ezra, and I want you to flip back there. Let me kind of go through the book with this. So look on page 113 of your book, and then I'll jump into where we left off. So remember with Ezra, first of all, there, I guess the first little paragraph talks about the guy named Zerubbabel, and Zerubbabel was one of the first ones to return to the land of Judah and Jerusalem. And his task was to rebuild the temple. Because in the destruction of Judah by the Babylonians, they destroyed the temple and all the homes, and they destroyed the wall around Jerusalem. So Zerubbabel is the first one to bring some exiles back to Jerusalem, to Judah. And they start to rebuild the temple. After Zerubbabel, then you've got this guy named Ezra. And Ezra comes back in the second paragraph on the page 113. He comes back as the priest, kind of as the preacher, as a teacher. So his job is to teach the Old Testament law to the people and to restore worship in the temple. So they come back. Zerubbabel begins a process of building the temple. Ezra comes back and teaches them how to worship in the temple. And then, after Ezra gets back and does that, you're introduced to the third main character, who is Nehemiah. So, if you flip through here, we went through the Ezra part, and then look on page, I guess it's 117, and you get to the book of Nehemiah, where we left off last year. Nehemiah's task, he was a cupbearer for the king. And at this point, I think I put this up here before, you've got the Assyrian Empire, you've got the Babylonian Empire, and then you've got the Persian Empire. So what happens is the Assyrians are in charge first, the Babylonians conquer the Assyrian Empire and take over all the world, and then Persia conquers Babylon and takes over all the world. So by the time you get to the book of Ezra and Nehemiah and Esther, we now have Persian kings in charge. So Nehemiah is a cupbearer to the Persian king. And I think they give the name here of Artaxerxes. That's a good one. Did you know in the Persian Empire there was a Xerxes and an Artaxerxes? So try to keep those straight. And not only was there a Xerxes, there was a Xerxes 1, Xerxes 2, Artaxerxes 1, and I think an Artaxerxes 2. So now, that's hard to keep straight. So Nehemiah, cupbearer, I told you last time, Nehemiah is known for his prayers. And throughout the book of Nehemiah, you can count 9 different times that he specifically shoots up short arrow types of prayers in the book. So he prays before he goes into the king. And here is Nehemiah's concern. Oh, Zerubbabel, I'm going to say he's Z. Z is concerned with the temple. and rebuilding the temple. When Nehemiah comes by or comes back, he's concerned about the wall around the temple. So every time you hear the word, the name Nehemiah, your brain is thinking, oh yeah, that's the guy who rebuilt the wall around Jerusalem when they returned from the exile. So I think I left off the middle of page 118. The primary task Nehemiah had was to rebuild the walls of Jerusalem. Now, you may think that's not that big of a deal. Look in Nehemiah and turn there to the book. Let me show you. I want to show you a section of the book, Nehemiah in chapter 2. Let's see here. Nehemiah chapter 2. Yes, verse 5, he wants to rebuild the walls. Verse 17, come let us rebuild the wall of Jerusalem. And what I want to show you as he did this, I'm going to try to point this out. Make sure I get it marked right. Yes, I'll show you in just a minute. All right, so here's the deal. You say, why do we care that Nehemiah comes back and builds a wall? All right, the wall around a city was their primary source of protection. It's very different in this Old Testament setting compared to what we have today. But even today, we may not necessarily build walls around, you know, the White House per se, or Washington D.C. or whatever was an important place politically. But we still put up barriers. Now, sometimes they're more almost digital barriers today, kind of invisible to us. I promise you this. Why don't you try to walk onto the White House lawn with a gun in your hand and see what happens? Okay, you will discover very quickly there are some protective barriers in place you can't see. Or how about the dude, wasn't there a guy one time that had the jetpack on and landed on the White House lawn a couple years ago? I mean, it's some crazy stuff out there. So just try it and see what happens. And before you do that, let me know your funeral wishes. Because I don't want to guess when we get to the funeral. I want to be able to say, all right, now, dummy there, before he landed on the White House lawn, wanted me to say this about him at the funeral. So, anyway. So the point is, they've got these very large, thick walls around every major city. Now, when I say wall, I'm talking walls on average, about 8 feet thick. Okay? We're talking about some serious walls. Sometimes in the Old Testament, you will find that with the walls, they were so thick and large, they would actually build homes into the walls. Okay, remember, I think it was Rahab in the book of Joshua. Her home was built into the wall. The soldiers would walk on top of the walls, 8 feet wide, that surrounded the city. So this is a very big undertaking for Nehemiah to come back and be so burdened for Jerusalem that he wants to rebuild the wall. Now, one thing about the walls you don't think about is I don't know exactly the distance between point to point, but a wall is not going to be a perfect circle in design. So you're going to have parts of the wall that will run this way for a while, hang a little left, run that way for a while, may hang on the left, may hang a right up here. Okay, all around that city. Now, here's what happens. At every spot where that wall changes direction slightly, there's a gate. But it's not the kind of gate you would expect. This is not a gate where you pull a little plunger, swing it open, make sure it clicks shut when you go into the pool yard. It's not that. But basically, they would have in that wall, this is what I remember they tried to show us. You would have, like, this side of the wall would go this way. The outside would kind of overlap, and you would create a zigzag in there. And that was kind of your gate. And what they told us, I thought was kind of interesting. They said the reason you've got kind of that zigzag in there, and it's more narrow, is so that when the enemy, if they try to attack, they can't run right through the gate on their horse. I mean, it makes sense. So you've got this little narrow, almost like a little bit of an overlap where you kind of like going to do this number to even get through that wall. So every spot where the wall changes direction, there's a gate like that. Let me show you what that looks like. In chapter 3 of Nehemiah, what you find all through that chapter, Nehemiah gives you the name of every gate that they worked on as they rebuilt the wall. So, for example, in the first verse of chapter 3, he lists the individuals who worked on the sheep gate. In verse 3, he lists the sons of Hasaniah that built the fish gate. You get into verse 6, he lists the sons there who repaired the old gate. Verse 13, another group of folks repaired the valley gate. Verse 14, another group worked on the refuse gate. Verse 15, there was a fountain gate. So all these different gates along the perimeter of Jerusalem as they're rebuilding the wall. Now let me show you on a map or a picture and chart kind of what that looks like. So if you think about the walls around Jerusalem, I got to put my glasses back on. I can see up close fine, I just can't see far away. All right, so this is a map or picture of the old city of Jerusalem. And on that chart or picture there, every gate is in blue. So you find like a fish gate on the left-hand side up top, sheep gate, I can't even read what that word is, Mithkad gate, east gate, horse gate, all the way around. So everywhere you've got a gate is a spot where somebody was stationed as they're working on rebuilding this wall. And there's a lot of gates around the city of Jerusalem. So all through chapter 3 of Nehemiah, he lists various gates that they would have to build, and this is all for the protection of the city of Jerusalem. Now remember the context. They've been in exile for 70 years. The temple's been destroyed. The wall has been destroyed. Zerubbabel comes back and rebuilds the temple. Ezra comes back and starts working on the people and the worship in the temple. Nehemiah comes back and his focus is on the wall around Jerusalem for protection. So everything in Nehemiah in this book is focusing on rebuilding the wall. Now there are some other things that come out in the book that I want to finish up with tonight. So the next little section here, I think this is what this like has helped me more than anything with this part of Israel's history. And I've alluded to it several times even before tonight. There's three primary items that have to be rebuilt once they return from 70 years of exile. Number one, they've got to rebuild the temple. Number two, they've got to rebuild, I like saying it this way, got to rebuild the wall. And number three, interesting, you got to rebuild the people. That was Ezra's job. So Zerubbabel works on the temple. Nehemiah works on the wall. And it's Ezra's job as the priest. Okay, Ezra, if Ezra were a member of our church, he would like this a lot. Because that was his focus. It does no good to rebuild the temple, rebuild the city, if you don't know how to worship God in that temple. You start making up your own rules or getting into idolatry, which is what sent them into exile, it's not going to do any good. You're wasting time. So Ezra's job is to be the preacher, the teacher, and to help the people know how to worship in that temple and how to live right before God. That is what Ezra and Nehemiah, these two books, are primarily about. The temple, the wall, and the people. All right, me be quiet. Anything that you want to ask or add, or do you want to start building an 8-foot wall around your house? Or, you know, if you have neighbors you don't like, you might want to. We've got good neighbors. I'm thankful. We've always had good neighbors since we moved here. In fact, did y'all knew this, that Penny Staples was my neighbor for several years when we were in the other house. So we've always had good neighbors. Thankful for that. All right, anything before I finish up the Nehemiah part? All right, let me tell you something. Let me give you one word. And just so you're aware of this, and it's what the rest of this section talks about, so I want to put it up here. So one of the things that you might not think about with Nehemiah, if you go to a bookstore and pick up a book or search for a book on leadership, and especially in more of like a Bible-based Christian leadership. Believe it or not, there are entire books that focus on leadership, and they're based on the life of Nehemiah. So let me show you why that is. So if you look now under the three little statements that summarize this period of their history, you see there that they put a subtitle on or in the middle of this page called A Leader Is. Now, I'm not going to worry about you unscrambling the stuff on the right hand side. I'm going to give them to you. But here are some things that come out in the book of Nehemiah that focus on leadership. And I'm not going to go through the verses. You can look those up later. But I just want you to look at this and consider the leadership that Nehemiah provided. Number one, a leader is an encourager. Now, here's what you find in Nehemiah's life. Nehemiah was always a man of vision. Okay, he's always trying to lead the people and encourage the people. It was Nehemiah who said, "Let's gather together and rebuild. Let's get to the task." He kept encouraging the people with the job before them, and he built confidence in the people as he did so. Nehemiah also shows us that a very good leader on a project like this is a person who is very coordinated. Now, we didn't look at it, but in chapter 3, when I gave you the different gates, guess what Nehemiah did? Nehemiah assigned a family or families to every gate and section of the wall. That's how organized and coordinated he was with the task. So Nehemiah shows us that it's important if you're leading a group. And listen, this is not just for church people or Christian stuff. This is anywhere, at the hospital, at the workplace, at Geico, wherever you are. If you are called to lead a group, these are principles that help everybody when it comes to leading. So being an encourager, a coordinator. Now, a warrior sounds a little bit strange, but Nehemiah actually set up guards as they worked on the wall. He set up guards because the enemies were attacking and ridiculing. So sometimes as a leader, you've got to also be kind of protective of your group, your company, your corporation, whatever it is. And Nehemiah shows us that, in fact, it wasn't only setting up guards, but Nehemiah himself stood beside his people and fought for what they were working on. So he is a warrior. Something else in Nehemiah's life, he was a planner. And I mentioned this earlier, he's got different shifts for guards and workers. There's a period of time where some of the families are working on their section of the wall, and then they're going to rest and sleep. Another one will come in and do their work. So very organized and planning for the task. He also, I really like this one, Nehemiah also was a servant. And if you've looked at or read anything much about leadership type material, in a Christian context, you will always find the term a servant leader. I have never seen in Scripture where a person who leads in the church, really anywhere, is to lord it over those that they're leading. One thing about Nehemiah in the story that I like a lot is he worked among them and not above them. Okay, he was a fellow worker on the wall. And if you get to a place where you think you've got a pedestal and you're above a certain group of people and you're above the requirements they have, you're above the qualifications, you're above the rules, you're above and above and above, and you forget that know you're part of the team as you work together, you're going to lose your team. And they're going to turn on you. They're not going to like you. And eventually, you may even fall because of your own prideful arrogance as a leader. So it's really neat with Nehemiah. He never took a position of prominence among the people. He always worked among them and not merely above the people. And I love that about Nehemiah. And the last one they have in the chart is he too was a friend of those who were in need. No matter how great Nehemiah became as a leader, he was always looking out for those who were in need. And in his situation, it was the rich folks who were exacting usury from the poor folks. And Nehemiah said, I'm not going to have it. So he's always looking out for other people. So those are some brief words about his leadership. And then the last little section here is some application for us with that leadership. And it's building right off of those words. To lead like Nehemiah, let me just put all these up here together. To lead like Nehemiah, encourage people. That's what Nehemiah did. He was an encourager, build confidence in people. Help people to work together. He continued to do that as a coordinator, as we saw earlier in the chart. He fought for God's truth as a warrior. Now in his case, it was a literal battle with the enemy, trying to distract them from the work. But it's always the case, no matter your calling, position, whatever, you're always going to have to stand for God's truth. And sometimes that requires taking up a sword. Now, I'm spiritually speaking, but sometimes it requires that. He always worked according, or we need to work according to God's plan, the strategy that Nehemiah used. Be a servant of others, the same thing. Don't work above people, work among them as a servant leader. And then, as Nehemiah did, be a friend to those who are in need and those who are weak. So, not many people look at the book of Nehemiah as a leadership book. His task was to rebuild the walls. But in the way he did that, you find some great principles for leadership. And I tell people all the time, these six statements here really need to be true in the church. If there's ever a place where people ought to work together and care for those who are weaker, in need, encouraging people, fighting for truth, standing for truth, serving one another, it's got to be in the church. Okay, if the lost world and lost leadership of a business or corporation doesn't follow common sense type principles, I'm not surprised, because they're usually after money. That's it, man. It's greed, pure greed. But in the church and Christian people, it needs to be different. And Nehemiah provides a good example for that. All right. What y'all think? Because I'm done with Nehemiah. And I'm going to move on to the next section. We have one more book in this section of the Old Testament. And once we get done with this, we are completely done with the history of the Old Testament. Everything else after the book of Esther, with the poetry books, Job, Psalms, Proverbs, Song of Solomon, Ecclesiastes, and all the prophets, they all fit into what we've talked about to this point. So we're at the very last book now of the history, for the most part, of the history of Israel. And that is this little book called Esther. Now look at the title of this lesson. I really like the title. They call this Saved by the Queen. So look on page 121. I don't know exactly the best way to go through Esther, because it is a narrative. It is a story. And if you're not familiar with it, you're really going to probably just need to read the book at some point. I just don't have time to go through all of it. But look at the top of page 121, and it's going to give you some context. So it says here that Esther lived a few years before Ezra and Nehemiah. Now, why is Esther in this place in your Bible? Esther is in this place in your Bible because her story, remember I had up here the Persian kingdom? Her story falls in the time frame of when Ezra was teaching the people and when Nehemiah was rebuilding the wall. Exact same time frame. So that's why she's in this section of your Bible. She lived a few years before Ezra and Nehemiah. Xerxes, who was the king of Persia, ruled in Persia at that time. Now, just as a side note with the parentheses, I know this is getting kind of deep, but sometimes Xerxes went by his other name, Ahasuerus. And so in my translation of scripture from the Hebrew language in verse 1, My Bible uses the word Ahasuerus here for the king of Persia. But sometimes you'll find the word Xerxes, exact same king. So Xerxes rules in Persia while Esther is there. Esther is born as an exiled Jew in Susa. All right, keep the context. Here we go. So we've got the exile, and they're there for 70 years. Okay, we've got a return of the people. But here's what you got to remember. Not everybody returned. Okay, Zerubbabel led a group back. Ezra led a group back. Nehemiah, he leads a group back. But not everybody returned. Guess who one of those was who did not return? It was Esther. That is why Esther, the entire story of Esther, takes place in Persia. She's not back home in Jerusalem. She's in Persia from the exile. So Esther she was born as an exiled Jew in Susa, which is the capital of Persia. Now check this out. Esther never saw Israel's homeland. She had never seen Jerusalem. She had never seen Judah. She was born in Persia, and that's where she's at when the story takes place. And she did not return with the others. And a lot of folks, I mean, there's others who didn't return either. So she never saw Israel's homeland. Yet, God used her to save all of the Jewish exiles from death. Now, let me give you a hint what's going to happen. Have you ever heard in history of a dude named Adolf Hitler? But guess what? Long before there was an Adolf Hitler, there was a version of Hitler in Esther's day, and his name was Haman. And what's going to happen is, in the story, this dude named Haman, and I'm going to go over it in just a minute, but the guy named Haman, who is very similar to Hitler, he wants to do away with all the Jews. Esther is still in Persia in the exile. Haman, of course, is a leader in Persia. He wants to destroy all the Jews. Guess who it is God uses to save the people from annihilation? It's Esther. You say, why is Esther in the Bible? Because Esther was the one God used to defeat the plans of Haman and protect the people of Israel. And you'll see that as we go through the chart. So she never saw Israel's homeland, yet she saved all of the Jewish exiles from death, thereby allowing many of them to return to the promised land. She's in Persia. Not everybody's returned, but through her valiant efforts, defeating the scheme of Haman, more people get to return and go back home to Jerusalem. Look at the next paragraph. Esther's story is recorded in the records of the Persian kings. I've said that it's during the time of Persia, from which Ezra or another scribe may have copied part of the story. The writer of Esther may have been in Susa at that time and even witnessed the events. We don't know for sure. But Esther became very famous among the Jews. Her story spread by word of mouth. So maybe the author even heard and investigated these accounts himself of Esther. We don't know exactly how he got all the information, but we've got the story of what happened. Now, in that chart at the bottom of page 121, I do not know the best way to handle this. So what I'm going to do is I'm going to put some statements up here and give you the letters that go with the statements, and then we're going to reconstruct the story. So if you don't get it all, just hang tight. But here's what you need to know. The lady named Vashti, which I'm going to redo this in just a minute. She goes with letter A. She is a queen in the story, in Persia. Refuses to obey the king. And when that happens, it sets into action everything that follows with Esther. So let me give you, I'm going to kind of give you the letters. We'll come back and redo the story. So you've got Vashti, queen to Xerxes. The king, who is Xerxes, is letter D and letter J. He marries Esther through a series of events. And then he also, as a king, gives the Jews the opportunity, letter J, to defend themselves against the attack and scheme of Haman, who was kind of Hitler back in Esther's day. So that is D and J. Then you've got a guy named Mordecai in the story. Mordecai is letter C and letter E. He is Esther's cousin who raises her. She's basically an orphan girl. Don't know what happened to her parents. It doesn't say, but she's raised by her cousin Mordecai. And it's also Mordecai with letter E. He hears about the assassination plot during the days of Haman and sends word to the king through Esther. And if you're not familiar with this story, you're like, I ain't got a clue what you're talking about. Just hang tight. We'll try to put it together in a minute. Then we've got old Hitler. He goes by the name of Haman in the story. Haman got real mad. That's letter F, letter G, and letter I. I should have put a third one up here. Haman, with letter F, gets mad because Mordecai, who is Esther's cousin, will not bow before him. Pride gets in his way. So he gets mad. Letter G, he is the one who influences the king to issue a decree that all the Jews should be killed. Okay, that's Hitler. Destroy and annihilate the entire Jewish race. That's what Haman is after. But at the end of the story, letter I, Haman ends up being the one who loses his life by hanging on the 75-foot gallows. Kind of ironic twist in the story. And then the last character, which of course is the main one here for us, is Esther. And she goes with letter B and letter H. Letter B says her name was also Hadassah. She's known as in chapter 2, verse 7. And then letter H says she is the one who bravely approached the king to ask him to save the Jews. So how are we going to put this together? I don't have a clue all the way. Look at your chart and let's see what we can do. So if you read through the book of Esther, let's see, King Xerxes, in number 2, decides to throw a big old party. And during his party, I'm going to summarize, during his party, he calls for the queen, Vashti. Vashti is a pretty queen, evidently, and he wants her to display her beauty for all of his drunk friends at the party. Guess what Vashti does? She says, I ain't coming. Whew, that's going to get you in trouble. That's going to get you in bad trouble. It got her in trouble. So when Vashti said, I'm not coming, I'm not displaying myself before all these folks in here drunk and whatever, then the king says, well, I'll tell you what then, you ain't going to be queen anymore. I'm going to search for a new queen. As he searches for a new queen, Esther becomes one of the contestants. Now, I'm going to jokingly call this a beauty pageant. All the women around the kingdom who wanted the chance to become queen would work on making themselves beautiful. They would spend days upon days. I don't remember the exact number. It's a long period of time. They're eating just right. It's really like a beauty pageant. And what happens is, the king, since he's kicked Vashti to the curb because she wouldn't obey him and come out to the party, he's going to select a new queen. All these ladies line up for the beauty contest. Esther is one of those. Well, guess who gets chosen? Esther gets chosen. So Esther becomes the new queen of Persia. So now she's married to Xerxes or Hashuerus. In the story, as the queen, she's got her cousin named Mordecai. Mordecai is also still in Persia. And Mordecai overhears some of the men in the kingdom who say, we are planning to assassinate the king. So Mordecai goes and tells Esther, Esther, you need to warn the king that these guys are about to assassinate him. So she warns the king. They discover the plot. And they, I think, end up being hung. I can't remember all that part of the story, but they lose their lives and it's over. All right. Then, in the midst of that section, the dude named Haman who is the king's right-hand man. Haman gets a position of authority. And Haman says, when I come through town, basically, you got to all bow before me. Mordecai wouldn't do it, because Mordecai is a Jew. He's only going to only bow before God. He's not bowing before this Haman. Well, that made Haman mad. So Haman said, I'll tell you what we're going to do then. I'm going to build a gallows 75 feet high, and I'm going to hang Mordecai on it. Well, the problem is the king one night couldn't sleep. And he said, why don't somebody bring me the history of the Persian kingdom? Because that'll help me fall asleep, which is kind of funny. And as he's reading about the history of the Persian kingdom, he comes across a story where Mordecai told Esther about the guys who were going to assassinate him. And he said, did we ever reward that guy for saying that and bringing that to our attention? They said, no, we didn't reward him. So the king says, we need to reward Mordecai for protecting my life. And that's what they do. Well, guess what? He tells Haman, Haman, I want you to parade Mordecai all through the streets and let everybody know this is the way the king honors a man of stature like Mordecai. That made Haman sick to his stomach. He can't stand Mordecai. So Haman goes home, and now he's really mad. And his wife still encourages him to tell the king to have Mordecai hung and get rid of him. But she said, I'll tell you this. If he's a Jewish person, you better be careful. Because I've heard about the God of the Jews. So Haman says, here's what I'm going to do. I am going to choose a day to annihilate all the Jewish people. That's Hitler. I'm going to destroy the Jewish race of people. He sends out posters to let everybody know that the day has been set to destroy all the Jewish people. Mordecai sees the poster, tells Esther, Esther, we're all about to die. And don't think just because you're in the king's palace here as a queen that you're going to survive, because you're also Jewish, and when they find out, you're going to die too. So here's what Mordecai says. Mordecai says, Esther, it just may be that God put you in this position for this exact time to save his people. So Esther's got to get her strength up and her courage up to go to the king. If she goes to the king without being summoned, she could lose her life. She takes a chance. She goes to the king, to Ahasuerus, to Xerxes, whatever you want to call him, and she says, I need to talk with you. And through a series of events, she ends up telling him, Haman is trying to destroy all of my people. It was Mordecai whom you honor. He's going to kill Mordecai. And the king says, oh no, we can't have that. So on a certain day, when the day when Haman was going to destroy all of the Jewish people, the king says, you are allowed to defend yourself and fight back and kill the Persians as they come in trying to destroy your people. And that's what they do. And end of story is the Jewish people are preserved because Esther had the boldness and courage to go to the king and say, Haman's about to kill all of my people. That is the story of Esther in a nutshell. That's where these five characters fit in. So you've got Vashti, the original queen, King Xerxes, you've got Mordecai as the cousin of Esther, Haman is the Hitler to kill all the Jewish people, and Esther is a hero of the story because she has the boldness to go before the king and plead for her people. And they defend themselves. And as a trivia question, there is a holiday that comes out of the story of Esther called Purim. And the Jewish people still observe that today because of what Esther did to protect them from annihilation back during this Persian kingdom. Okay. Hoping I thoroughly confused you. So what I just shared with you in this chart, when you read through Esther, just look for that storyline and you'll see it happen there like that. All right.